So I wanted to take a different approach today on my show, and I wanted to talk about philosophy. Yeah. Can philosophy be sexy? I don't know. But this woman, I met her a month ago. I had the pleasure of working with Professor Wells from George Washington University. And she is a philosophy teacher. And I wanted to know about philosophy. I wanted to know, you know, what is it? What makes it, you know, so deep? But also, can philosophy be sexy? You know, I had to put that in there. So she's going to spend a few minutes with us and talk about what she does, how she does it, and can philosophy be sexy? But also, we're going to talk about the opera, because she has started a group of women who she embraces and shows and teaches us about loving the opera. Now, your girl, I'm not going to lie. I mean, yeah, it's a stretch, but I'm willing to learn. I'm willing to hear it. So, you know, buckle up. We're going to talk about philosophy in the opera. Oh, my God. It starts now. Welcome back. We are joined today by Vanessa Wells, Dr. Vanessa Wells. She is a philosophy teacher at George Washington University. And, you know, I met her doing a photo shoot, and I just fell in love with her spirit. And I think it's because she teaches philosophy. And I didn't know what philosophy was. So I was, you know, all giddy and trying to find out what it was. And then I looked it up, and it says, quite literally, the term philosophy means love of wisdom. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, I said, oh, my God, you know, wisdom equals getting older. You know, love means loving yourself, loving the world, whatever. So this is why I have Professor. Do you want me to call you Dr. Professor or just Vanessa?
I mean, you can just call me Vanessa. Yeah. Although I love the sound of it, but Vanessa is just fine.
Because, you know, when I'm drinking, I call her Nessa.
Yes.
So I'll call her Vanessa. Welcome to my podcast. So
Thank you.
We need to know exactly what you do. Now, you know, your whole vibe is phenomenal. I love your whole vibe. And for those of us who don't know what philosophy is, I'm going to just throw it out there. Why philosophy?
Well, philosophy is notoriously difficult to define in a extremely succinct way. But I tend to look at it as a methodology. What I'm usually trying to help my students develop is a set of strategies for deciding whether or not any argument is worth accepting. Should I believe what I'm being told? What is it that I think about the world? How ought I to act? And what kinds of questions do I need to ask and answer in order to determine that? Mm-hmm. And so because philosophy is very much bound up with that practice of not only seeking answers, but also figuring out how you even know when you've landed on the right answer, and how you decide what is the set of questions that I'm hoping to answer, and why those questions, right?
Right.
It's something that, at least certainly in a pedagogical space, my students tend to find that they can also take to all of their other pursuits as well. And so even if I have students who aren't philosophy majors, they often report back to me like, oh my goodness, you know, this class has helped me so much in terms of becoming a more kind of rigorous and deep and penetrating critic, right, of reality, right, or at least what's being presented to me as reality. So Wow. Those are, I mean, those are some of the reasons. And I think that attracted to me to philosophy as well when I was an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. I knew that as my interests changed over time, philosophy would be a good home for them, because philosophy, there's philosophy of science and philosophy of literature and philosophy of history. There's so many different sub-disciplines of philosophy to engage with as well.
So, you know, what's so sexy about philosophy? Is there something sexy about philosophy? Because, you know, I always want to have something sexy about this show. So can it be, can philosophy be sexy?
You know, it's such a great question, because I have to confess, I just don't know. And it's funny, I've never thought about that question myself personally. And it's interesting. I think it's because, especially as a teacher, I'm usually like, you know, in that space, I'm presenting in the most like asexual way possible. Right. It's funny. I mean, if anything is sexy about philosophy, and that's a big if, people mostly find philosophers a little bit annoying, which is probably also part of what I find funny about the question. Like,
oh my God,
most people do not love like hanging around with like groups of philosophers.
Yeah, because what you talk about, like what is your conversations? Like, you know, I think of philosophers like Socrates and Plato and Karl Marx. I mean, and you do not fit that stereotype. I mean, you are drop dead gorgeous. And I look at you and I think, you know, a philosophy professor does not look like you. Mm-hmm. Because if I saw you coming into a classroom, and you're just like, you know, I'm professor, I'm teaching. I'm like, what? Really?
Right.
Where's the craggly old, you know, whatever, right. So do you get that from your students? Like when you first walk in the room, you sashay in, you got your stuff, you got your books and stuff. And people are like, who is this chick? And you're sometimes, like, I am your philosophy, your philosophy teacher.
Yeah, sometimes I get it less and less now. And I think that's, you know, right now I've been at George Washington for several years. And so many of my students already know me by reputation, even if they haven't met me before. So I experience less of that, like, oh, you're the professor? What?
Right.
But I have experienced that in my career. Where, you know, I walk up to the front and exactly there's this sort of like brief confusion. It's interesting. I think that question of like, what does a philosopher look like? First of all, there actually is a blog. It's defunct now. But there actually is a blog, and I think it was called like, this is what a philosopher looks like.com or something like that. Yeah. And it's precisely directed at the sort of broader stereotypes about what a philosopher would look like a, you know, an elderly white man.
Right.
Like orating from above somehow.
And, with a bow tie.
Right. With a cute little bow tie, you know, looking dapper. Right. Or disheveled with the, always with the bow tie.
Exactly.
But the question reminds me of this one incident that happened. This was years ago, and I was in an audience to hear a philosopher speak, and the event was not put on by a philosophy department. It was put on by another school, and this was not GW. This is a different university.
Mm-hmm.
And the host of the event, he got up front and he told this little anecdote, and he says, "Oh, you know, I walked over to those two people." He points to two older white men, right? He points to two older white men, and he says, "I walked up to those two, and I said, I know you two, you've got to be the philosophers."
Oh.
Now, the funny thing is, they were. They, in fact, were members of the philosophy department.
Okay.
But what I found curious is that I was sitting next to another philosopher who was also a person of color. And I'm thinking, well, we're philosophers, you know, like,
yeah.
Why don't we look like philosophers? And right. It kind of goes both ways because, A, there's these like broader kind of assumptions about what philosophers would look like, professors in general, mm-hmm. but also philosophy itself is overwhelmingly white and male, actually.
Right. Exactly.
You know, so that's a real thing. You know, we as a discipline has been a stubborn problem as well. Wow. I mean, people have been talking about it for as long as I've been a philosopher, you know, and yeah. With some movement, but not nearly enough. But yeah, I think it's important to I think it's important to I don't know. I feel like representation, that word gets kind of overused in some ways. And mm-hmm. sometimes we put more weight on representation than I think representation alone can actually bear.
Right.
But I do think that it's, you know, I like that I can represent philosophy and be like, yeah, you know, like actually philosophers can be Black women from Philly, you know, like we can be literally a philosophy professor.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's important. And then there's all sorts of interesting things. Like one thing, and I'll just end with this for now, but I realized some years back, my dissertation in grad school was on Marxism and ethics. And at some point, I learned that a number of Black philosophy PhDs, so Cornel West,
right,
Charles Mills, who recently passed away, and he was a philosopher, very prominent in critical race theory. Tommy Shelby, who is a professor at Harvard, and there's like one or two more, it's not an exhaustive list, had all written their dissertations on Marx and ethics.
Wow.
Which is a very, yeah, which is wow. this extremely niche kind of question. There's not, right. it's not like a big school of thought in academic philosophy writing about this stuff. So it's there's something, right, that's sort of brought even to the kind of long-standing traditional like canon. There's even aside from the importance of things like philosophy of race that tend to be disproportionately done by Black philosophers, or feminist philosophy that tends to be disproportionately done by female philosophers, there's also like even just when it comes to the sort of old canon or whatever, there's something about that particular perspective that gives a fresh look at it. And so it's important for all sorts of reasons.
So do you think that philosophy can help us in these difficult times? Because we're in a moment now where, yeah, and I dare say, I mean, I personally have seen friends that are just dealing with a lot of mental issues and a lot of mm-hmm. mental challenges. And, you know, it's kind of scary that, you know, when you see it, you don't recognize it. You know, I asked my best friend, I saw a friend who was, you know, posting some stuff, and I was a little concerned mm-hmm. about this person. And, you know, she said, you know, just let it go, you know, let him or her do what they have to do. And, you know, I want to reach out, but I don't. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, can philosophy help us and them and whoever is listening to this podcast in these difficult times that we're dealing with right now?
I think so. I think it can help to detangle problems. I think oftentimes I'm thinking about how I use philosophy in my own life when I'm, you know, having some challenge, and also what kind of advice I usually give to others. And I think the, I think one of the things that philosophers as a whole in general are good at is being able to separate things that seem like, that might look like one thing at first, and then you take a more careful analysis of the situation and you see that actually maybe there are 2, 3, 4, or 5 different things that all need to be separated out and thought about, right? You know, maybe I'm having some kind of conflict with a loved one, and I think to myself, well, if they act like that, it must mean that they don't love me. But then, as a wise philosopher, right, you know, I might really like say, well, wait a second, does it actually mean that? Is it actually true that the presence of this emotion they've displayed or their utterance of this statement that they've made necessarily entails this much deeper, like, existential fact about their feelings toward me or about the value of their relationship, right? And I might realize that it doesn't. And then I might be able to ask myself, okay, well, what does it mean then, right? And, you know, those are the kinds of things that, I mean, one of the things that I think is very significant about philosophy is that a lot of the things that we do to try to understand the world or understand our place in it or our place in one another's lives is it's a professionalized and honed version of the same kinds of things that all of us do all the time, trying to make sense of the world. But the question is just, you know, maybe having a particularly sharp grasp of formal logic, right? Which comes in handy. Does this actually entail that? No, it doesn't, right? Okay, what does it entail? Being able to sort of pause and step back and look at a problem, which is the kind of thing, you know, that good therapists help you do, right? So I think that's one of the, things, or one of the ways that sort of having a philosophical frame of mind and having those tools very sharp and ready to hand can be helpful with. And, you know, and I think like when I give advice to friends, that's often what I hear reflected back as the thing that people find helpful as well, right?
So you're literally carrying a miniature couch with you, and people are lying down to talk with you because I feel so at ease right now.
Oh, good. Yes, yeah, I do like, too.
when I asked that question, and you kind of put me into a different mindset, and you literally probably like, you go to a party. I mean, I can see you now, Vanessa. You're at a party and someone is saying that they had something going on and you start talking 3 drinks in and they're just like, okay, can I go home with you? Because you just changed my whole attitude. and is that what philosophers do? I mean, is that what your teachings do? Like put people in a better state of being?
I think I never thought about it like that, but I definitely would not disagree with that framing, because I think often we move really fast.
Yeah,
I mean people in general. We want to feel like we already have the answer, and we want to move quickly and just act on whatever feels like a good enough approximation of the reality of the situation. And philosophers are, one of the things I talk about with students in particular is this idea that philosophers want to know what is absolutely certain and true beyond any possibility of doubt. So there's a philosopher named Descartes who that's the one who has the famous line, "I think, therefore I am."
Yeah.
And that sentence, "I think, therefore I am," it comes up in the course of him trying to figure out what is it that he thinks he knows that actually can't be doubted. And he says, well, you know, I can see my chair and I can see the room I'm in and et cetera, et cetera, and so forth. But then he asks himself, well, how do I know for sure? Couldn't I be under the delusion of an evil demon that wants me to be deceived? And if that's true, if that's a possibility that I can't rule out right off the bat, then what is it that I think I know that would stand up to that kind of challenge? And he concludes, well, the only thing that I could know beyond any doubt is that I am thinking. Because even if I think that I'm wrong, or if I think that I have made a lot of mistakes, I'm still thinking. So that's something I can believe without doubt. And then I go from there and I use that as the sort of foundation of the rest of my body of belief. So that's one example of what it looks like for philosophers to be asking, well, what is it that I can say that I know with absolute truth and certainty? And now Descartes is just one philosopher among many. I'm not saying, you know, that's very far from being everyone's strategy. But interestingly, like in the Western, like in the Anglophone philosophical tradition, at least, almost everybody reads Descartes when you're a college student and you're learning how to do philosophy. It's one of the first things that everyone is introduced to, even though, you know, you might sort of very quickly move on to some other set of ideas, right? And but in general, philosophers are trying to figure out what is it that I can say that I know. And it's a lot less than most of us probably assume, right? Or somebody like Socrates, who was regarded as very wise, right? But himself said that his wisdom consisted in his being aware of how little he knew. And that's because he was constantly challenging everything. Or somebody like Karl Marx writes that that his aim in the kind of intellectual work that he's doing is to engage in the ruthless criticism of all that exists, right? So it's this idea of just like this unrelenting curiosity and inquisitiveness about the world and wanting to be sure, like, what is it that we can really know? And so a lot of times, to bring it back to the question of like personal interactions, we might assume we know lots of things about what the other person is thinking, right, what their motivations are, why they did it, what it means, that they were trying to get a rise out of me, right? But maybe, you know, you get into your philosophical frame of mind, right? And you say, do I actually know any of that? You know, maybe I'm making a lot of assumptions. You know, what? Maybe I know some things about what I want, though, and I know some things about what I'm willing to put up with. Okay, that's a different thing. You know, so it's like, it is an example of like one of those places where it can be helpful to just kind of like slow down and to be willing to have a kind of humility about what it is that you might be counting as knowledge.
So
now, do actual philosophers, like, are we actually very good at that? You know, like, of course it varies all the time. There's, you know, but I do think that's part of the enterprise, is to try.
Well, I this is a show about embracing life, embracing getting older and loving life. And I know this is probably going to be my last question, but I'm going to bring her back on because she has another thing that I think is so awesome. And I'll tell you as soon as I ask this last question, but we're getting older. We're a lot of people that are around us are dying or death or whatever. Mm-hmm. Can philosophy help us prepare for that? Or can that assist us in accepting this person is gone? We're going to go, you know, my biggest fear, and I'm sure it's a lot of people, is this the final frontier? Is this it? How can philosophy help us with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, death is a consistent theme in a lot of philosophical writing. Just thinking, because I just mentioned Socrates, I'll just mention that he had a theory about how we gain certain knowledge, and he thought it was only in death. When we're in the world, we're surrounded by all sorts of things that are such as to delude and deceive, and that are incomplete. And but when we die, he thought we go up to the realm of forms, and when we're there, we have direct access to the true conceptual, untainted form of real things. And then we see what a circle really is, because everything that exists in reality as a concrete circle is actually a little bit off, right?
You know? Yeah, yeah.
But in death, we can apprehend the real form of a circle. And then when we come back to the real world, we use that knowledge we gained in death, right? And are able to say, oh, well, you know, that's not quite a circle, but I know that it is approaching circularity, because I apprehended the true form of a circle in the realm of forms in the afterlife, right? So I think that question of the meaning of life, the meaning of death, what death is, whether there's an afterlife, what it means if there is one or isn't one, that's that is definitely a kind of constant matter of interest for philosophers. For myself, it's such an interesting question. Like, does it help with thinking about death? I mean, I would say yes.
Okay.
And I think it, but I'm struggling to be very specific. I'm trying to think of, you know, I'm thinking of like recent, I think it helps in the same way, in similar ways to what I mentioned a moment ago, that, you know, being able to have a kind of, being able to sort of like step back and see things in their context. But I don't know. That's a tough one. I just lost a cat. Yeah, that's the most recent passing that I experienced. I think the main way it helped me in that moment was thinking about what it means to be there for a loved one, like in terms of duty.
Yeah.
I think in that moment, I'm not saying that that's one size fits all, but I think in that particular moment, it helped me have the sort of strength to just do what my cat needed.
Yeah.
And I remembered you know, the vets, the veterinarian's office, they were saying to me, my mom was with me too, and they were like, you guys are wonderful cat parents, and you know, like you did a great, you're doing so good. And I know that like lots of people aren't right. And like, and don't like treat their animals well, and aren't there with them in their final moments.
Right.
And I understand that that's because it's hard. It's not pleasant. It's, you know, but I cannot wrap my mind around what it would be like to not do it. You know, like, and I think, and then it's hard to say, like, well, you know, I am an ethicist, that like within philosophy, that's my specialization, and it's hard to say which comes first, the chicken or the egg. Like, did I become a moral philosopher because I already was the sort of person who would say, well, I don't understand, that is the thing that we ought to do, so what other considerations could possibly be at play here?
And the loss of a pet is just so devastating. It really is.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's devastating.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry about you going through that, because I definitely can relate. It's that's a very hard pill to swallow.
Yeah. And I think just like having that clarity made it a little easier, mm-hmm. And just being, having that clarity, having that ability to kind of like step back and say, well, here are the various kinds of considerations, and here's just what needs to be done. And maybe that played a part. But as I say, it's hard to know which comes first, because like, I probably also became a philosopher because I already was thinking about those things. Like, I think that I was already thinking philosophically. I mean, everybody does, actually, but I think that I was always a little bit more inclined to be like, well, you know, why is this like that? Or I remember when I was a child thinking to myself, well, we talk about time passing, but how do we know that we're not actually being instantaneously teleported to different like realities?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because we don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know. I mean, you just don't know. I mean,
we don't.
Exactly. There is another question, but I know we're out of time, but I want to bring you back, because Vanessa started a group of that encourages women to embrace the opera. And, she was telling me about it, told her I didn't like musicals, but I know opera is so much different than a musical. And I really want to bring you back to talk about that, because a lot of women, people, opera. Mm-hmm. Or when they hear the opera, they just think Pavarotti. I mean, and it's so much different. It's so much more vast. And you have actually started a group of women that you go to the Kennedy Center, you go to, you know, the opera house or whatever, and you show them how to embrace it, and you teach them, and you listen to, like, what would you like to hear? Or what would you like to learn? And then you base your suggestions based on what they're telling you.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I love opera, and for years I would just describe myself as an opera enthusiast who didn't really know much about opera though. Mm-hmm. And then like after a while, after, you know, I think at some point I did the math and I realized that I had been going to opera and listening to opera and thinking about opera consistently for a decade, and yet still thought of myself as, I just am sort of interested in it. And the truth is, I'm not an opera expert or anything like that. But I love opera, and mm-hmm. I get a lot of enjoyment out of it, and it makes me sad that it does kind of have this reputation for being inaccessible yeah. when it's when like actually I think a lot of opera is actually very accessible, and I think it's one of the things I really liked about it when I first started going. And the cheapest tickets at the Metropolitan Opera House are like $25.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You know, so there's and then there's opera that's shown in movie theaters that is a great experience, and that's like $20, you know.
Amazing. Yeah, we're gonna definitely bring you back for that, because you know, my whole misconception of that is like, you know, I have to dress up, you know, my date has to wear a tux, and we have to talk like this.
Right.
I'm going to the opera.
And you can, you know, like you can.
I'm going to the opera and see Pavarotti.
Yeah, and most opera houses are so delighted to have people come that they are not trying to make anybody feel uncomfortable if you show up in jeans, like at all.
Oh.
A couple years ago, the Bavarian State Opera House in Munich, they had this social media campaign, and on their Instagram, they were like, well, people wonder, what should you wear to the opera? And they're like, we don't care. They're like, wear anything, just buy a ticket and get over here, you know. Like, and I think that's basically every opera house, pretty like I have gone dressed up to the nines, and I've gone in jeans, you know. Oh, wow. It just really doesn't matter, just be comfortable.
Well, we're going to talk about that when I bring you back, but it has been such a pleasure.
Thank
learning,
you for having
talking
me.
About philosophy with Professor Vanessa Wells over at George Washington University. And I couldn't stop the interview. I just mm-hmm. were just so interesting. And it's just refreshing to feel, like I said, you literally need to have a small couch with you and people just sit there and listen to you, because you're so easy to, what you're putting out is what we need to hear.
I need like a little salon.
Yeah,
you know?
You do. yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
With someone playing harp
and singing in the background. Whoa!
Yes.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Hi, this is Juanita, and if you enjoy listening to this podcast, please give it 5 stars or thumbs up. And if you want to be a part of It Starts Now as a guest or as a sponsor, because we would love to have you, please let us know. And we will try to get an episode out once a week. I love doing this. I love spreading the word about what's going on in my life and what's going on with the changes as we get older, because it does start now. So like us, love us, sponsor us. We would love to have you. Until next week.